December 10th, the planning commission, to order at 7:01. Can we take attendance, please?
Yep. Chairman Lutz. Commissioner Demarest.
Here.
Commissioner Dirksen. Commissioner Christensen.
Here.
Commissioner Rodland.
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood.
Here.
Commissioner Tuttle.
Here.
Thank you. Okay, at this time we open up the for comments to citizens, from the citizens, to on anything that is not on tonight's agenda. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to make any comments that are not on tonight's agenda? I don't see any hands. Okay, so let's move on then. The approval of minutes, I don't see any minutes in front of us.
We actually don't have any ready for tonight.
Okay.
Final break.
And then next item on the agenda is the public hearing. The rules of Elk Grove rezone are the 2011-01. Paul, do you want to make a comment on what's going on there?
Yeah, we're asking the commission to continue the public hearing to March 13th of next year. What we've done is gone back and initiated a fresh SEPA process, a new updated environmental checklist. There'll be a determination coming out. And while that's in process, while we go through the SEPA process and comment and appeal period and so forth, we do want to put the rezoning on hold during that time so that when we come back, we can reopen the continued public hearing and then continue to take testimony on the rezoning at that point. And I should say that in the meantime, the proposed subdivision that we've had some discussion, Bear Mountain subdivision, has been basically tabled. The application's been sent back to the applicant with some review comments, but it is on hold until the rezoning is complete. There's two separate issues.
Okay.
But our plan is to continue, not close, but continue the public hearing until we can come back for some reconsideration on the rezoning, or ignite the discussion again on the rezoning.
Okay. Do we need two actions then on this, or just one?
I think we need just one, to a motion to continue the public hearing to March 13th.
March 11th.
I'm sorry, March 11th, 2013.
Okay. Commissioners, any discussion on that? Any
question for staff? And that relates to the letter that's in front of us this evening.
Right.
Comments.
I neglected to mention. Sorry, Jeff. We did get a letter submitted this morning from the HOA of the Foothills, HOA Board of the Foothills, requesting that the rezoning exempt or exclude the two parcels that are adjacent to the Foothills along their western boundary. That would be the Bear Mountain subdivision piece, which is about 20 acres. And I assume they're referring to another parcel that's on the north end of that same boundary of the subdivision, to exclude those from our action on rezoning the Roosevelt Road property in total. When we come back to it in March, as we consider that, their request is to pull back to those parcels, and that's something that can be discussed and or addressed when we do consider the zoning.
Okay. So that would come back then on the March meeting.
Could certainly be part of the discussion, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it will be.
Okay. Anything else? Anybody? No? Okay, so I guess I could entertain a motion then to units.
I'm happy to make that motion, but I would like to ask one more question before I go there. Paul, am I correct in that this would not be the time for us to suggest removal of these properties from that rezone? I think that's, or to even discuss it for that matter.
So you can certainly discuss it as a matter of discussion. I don't believe there's any action to be taken tonight since we're continuing the public hearing. But we, you know, there's no reason why we couldn't discuss it this evening.
I don't know that I have anything to discuss about it. I appreciate the comment being brought forward. It certainly ties in with the whole discussion that's already taking place with respect to access for that area. And I think that's the main point there. And we certainly don't want to lose sight of this as we move through the process.
Right.
And I'm happy to leave it at that at this point.
Okay.
And with that, I'd be happy to make a motion then that we continue RZ 2011-01. Continue the public hearing and public testimony portion of that hearing on the Roosevelt Road rezone to, what was it, March 11th?
Yes.
2013.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion made by Commissioner Demarest, seconded by Commissioner Roslin. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. Okay. All right. Next thing is the on the agenda is the workshop for sign code update. Who's carrying the ball on this? Mark?
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Mark Lancamera. I'm a planner with the City of Monroe, and I am charged with just sort of kicking off the workshop tonight on sign code revisions. We have John Beckwith here, who is our hired consultant, who is continuing the process from the last meeting we had 2 weeks ago, and he has quite a bit of information to share. I'll be trying to keep up with him on the computer, but I would like to introduce Tom Beckwith and have him move forward. And like I said, I'll try to switch slides appropriately.
Thanks, Mark. We got started on the what your existing ordinance says, and then begin to morph into what different. Better ways maybe of expressing it than maybe in some proposals. But we left the session saying we really needed to kind of look at what the sign design guidelines could do, show good examples of what those could be. And while these won't be embodied inside the basis of the ordinance itself, the ordinance will allow for sign design guidelines to be examples of what you prefer to be good illustrations of what you want to achieve. So I brought three things tonight. I brought some of the inventory work I did on some of your existing conditions, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then to go through very quickly the design guidelines so you can see what's in that and whether it works for you or not. And then I'll show you the work that I'm doing on the table itself. Not completely done with it, but I'll show you what I'm working on, get your comments on whether or not you're comfortable with that. Be okay?
Okay.
These look very bright on my computer screen, but they look a little dark on the screen here. Can we dim
them? We'll go ahead and maybe dim the fluorescence. It'll make the screen pop much better.
Well,
just turn off.
Oh, perfect. These are good examples of the good of wall signs. Actually, this one is the better example. It's on Freeland Avenue, and it's a series of retail storefronts, as you can see, and these are the signs that are put in the kind of the building faces to define what's inside. Now, it's not so much the contents of each of those signs as their size and their placement. And you can see they're well-designed proportionally to fit their spaces that they want to call out, and they have some life to them, although this photo is a little dark. One of the problems with taking outdoor pictures is it's great if the sun's shining on your building because you get nice, good lighting. But if it's in the winter, as we are now, it's a little difficult to pull it out. Nonetheless, those are good examples. And there is a bit of a room left here to name the building. Now, this is one of your buildings in Main Street, and it's kind of done the same thing. You see it calls out the building up here, and then it has what it wants to call out to be what the major use inside the store is. And while it's properly sized, it looks a little out of place because this building's side wasn't designed to accept signage. In those days, the front was on Main Street, so the front would have had the setup and the design of the building to accept the signs. Actually, what's it sitting across is what we call transom windows. In the old days, the ceilings were up above here, and these windows were what provided the upper light. So while that sits there and it's proportionally in size, it doesn't look as comfortable as this does. And if we're on the other side of the building, it would. Now, something that they did here, though, you can see the window signs. They've got a repetition of kind of their logo down on the bottom, which is below the eye level. So when you're looking into the storefront and through the windows, you're seeing what their goods are at a comfortable eye level as you walk by. Now, this is on Freeland Avenue also. These are not big signs. You can see the subway, and this calls out, I think, the key restaurant in the building. But the reason that they work so well is you see the background is a darker color and it pops that sign. So size is not as important as how the placement works. Now, these could be dropped anywhere within those bands as opposed to these things which have to fit within a box. But these are good examples. These work pretty well. Yeah, next page, please. These are also good signs of a different kind. These are wall signs, all right, but you can see what they've done is they've created and applied over top of that kind of some logo elements and some color. And in the Red Robin, that's very definitely their logo element, but you see it's on a red frontage base, and so it stands out. It doesn't really need to be very big. And this is Tuscaro, is that how you pronounce that? Good. I'll let you do that. But it has also this whole piece on top of the building is to set up that sign. And later on, you can see it's used kind of the arc base and the arc base here to kind of replicate that. Now, there's a couple other good signs in here, too. This is a multi-directory type of sign. You see it's kind of set in a nice frame. And those different panels are different colors, and so therefore they're distinguishable. Now, the ones that work the best are the ones with a color background as opposed to those that are white background. White background is a lot harder to read than it is a color on top of a face. And this is also a real estate sign. That, again, that's got the two poles. And these are done pretty well, too. They kind of have a full face, and even though it's white, it does look crisp. It does look clean. It doesn't look like it just stuck up there on a stake. These are pylon signs, and really this goes to the cinema that's down the street. And these are reader boards, and they're always going to be colors on white backgrounds because the sign is backlit, and there isn't any way that you could make that a dark color without being able to illuminate anything. So these go white with either red or black letters, but what works well is the pylon. And the pylon itself, you see, if we were to measure the sign, we would measure these faces, we measure maybe that face, but we wouldn't measure the pylon. And the pylon is its frame, and it makes it look substantial. And it does that on both of these cases. And in this case, they've added some sculpture elements to it. The only thing that's a little out of place is the base is just a little bit overemphasized. Because really what your eye is drawn to is that full vertical element. These are also not very big.
Tom, I think that's the same sign.
It
what you've
is.
Seen at the top is the what's on top of the building.
Behind it, that's true. And there's looking at one side and there's looking at the other side.
Yeah.
Next. These are also good signs, and you can see this is a theater, and that's what's on top of it, all right. But you see the color that's introduced into the building itself, it kind of defines it. The signage is very little. It doesn't need an awful lot of signage. The pylon helps, of course, establishes what the use is. And then you see they do have some kind of posters down here to say what's playing. Now up in here, you can see how they carry this motif through, and that's a small wall sign. But the nice thing is that the base, the color of the building itself is not all white. It's kind of a muted color, so this is easier to distinguish than if we were, say, a white, black and white sign on a white building. Those are all good examples. This is at least what I call bad, in the sense here, as you see, the Safeway's on a pole. That's kind of like a swizzle stick. The same with the Jack in the Box, and then they hung something off of that sign. And the same with this multi-directional sign. They pushed it up into the sky to make it visible. And so too is the famous Les Schwab tire sign. They're good signs in the sense that they get across what they want to say, at least. They get across their brand and their product. But they look like they're just tacked up into the sky. And the issue is, it doesn't matter how high these are made, they're still going to look somewhat out of place. Now, by comparison, you can see the Safeway sign has two poles, has a good base. The only issue is, it seems to be bigger or higher than it really needs to be. This is a very well-established brand, and it doesn't take a lot of visibility for you to be able to see it as you drive down the street. This is also more, at least in my opinion, bad. In this case, you can see they painted the building to get it to stand out, but in so doing, it kind of reduces the signs to being inconspicuous or beside the point. And then you can see these look like temporary signs. In addition to that, they put these banner poles, which are really not appropriate within a pedestrian area. They take up sidewalk space, and they're really, banner poles like that are designed for along the roadway, not within pedestrian areas. As a comparison, the other extreme is, this is a sanitary building that's all white with absolutely no signage to it at all, and in some respects, no interest to it either. It just looks plain, vanilla plain, and doesn't have signage that indicates either what it is or how it's to be used. Another thing that was done wrong here is, you see all the stuff that's in the windows? It kind of detracts from your ability to see into the store to see what's going on, or into the restaurant. This is an interesting sign. It's got a lot going on for it. It's very colorful, and it's very well lit up when it does, but it also looks like it couldn't support itself proportionally. And we know it can. It just visibly, it looks kind of odd. And it is very big for what it's promoting. This is the Rite Aid sign, and that's about as plain as you can get. They're using their awning, and then they're just dropping in the big words Rite Aid. And certainly it gets across what it is, but it's not very visually exciting. Next. And this is the ugly. This is the Goodyear tire promotion. It's probably been there forever. You probably the same with the chain bumpers and the Coca-Colas. And you can see this is a sandwich board sign at a major road intersection. There's no reason for that to be introduced except in a pedestrian area. And here now we have a sign that says, "Now we're open." And you know, I'll bet you that's probably been there for months as well. But they tend to add clutter, and they don't really add any additional information or any really useful advertising message. Now open could be anywhere. Coca-Cola could be anywhere. And even though this is a Goodyear product, the Goodyear store itself is well identified. So these are kind of redundant signs. And these are the kinds that usually get pushed on the franchisers to be put up in their yard or put on their buildings, just because they're part of the franchise chain. They'll come down and say, "Put them up." Next. This, however, is when you put it all together, this is, see, the Safeway sign and the KFC sign, they're actually not so bad, even though I don't prefer single pole signs. But you look what's down here at the bottom. Those are all sandwich board signs on a major roadway. There are no pedestrians there, no reason for it. But when you put it all together, it's cluttered. And the same thing is true here at the 76 station. Down here we have posters, we have another banner, and if you look at the windows, we have an even more promotional material stuck in the windows so you can't see inside. Now, if all that were taken out, this wouldn't be as garish. The same thing is true here. There's posters, there's temporary signs, and there's banners, and those three things combined tend to create more of an impression of sign clutter than say, these elements per se. And also the question is, since they're not really passing any useful information on about their businesses, and in some cases, since they're oriented towards pedestrians rather than necessarily anybody else, what's the reason for it? Okay.
Next.
Let's go to sign design guidelines. I think it's that one right there.
First one?
Yeah. Can you do Now, be honest with you, these design guidelines we keep developing every time we do an ordinance. So there's a lot of material in here that's come from the last time we did. And there'll probably be material we'll add in just from you. So they tend to grow. But I think that as we go through it, the issue is, does it give cost the information that you want to give anybody that's coming in to do advertising in town? Keep in mind, these are not mandatory. It's difficult to codify this in an ordinance and then start passing on design content. This is more effective. You say, this is what we think is good. Manchester would be better. It would be cool. If you do less than this quality, we'll encourage the other guys to come down and bitch at you. Peer pressure. Okay. Let's go. Go. One more page. Now, one of the issues is the purpose of sign design guidelines, and these are some of the things that allow you protection in court, and it's really why you even have sign ordinances to begin with. And the first is the city's character is determined by these collected images of everything, including signs, and increasingly by its advertising signage. That defines your character. So it's kind of oxymoron to be worried about the design of the buildings if you're not also looking at the signage, which is, in some cases, can overpower whatever the building is. The second is, good designs are not more expensive. There isn't anything, as you'll see in these examples, that costs them more other than thought. It's the same material, the same lighting. In some cases, they even be a little smaller than what you did if you just simply tried to make your sign as big as possible. So the idea that good design is expensive is not true. Good designs result from a process that includes thought, planning, so on and so on and so on, not necessarily more money. These guidelines provide illustrated concepts that realize a desired design state. And you'll see as we go through them, we do give what we think are things to do and things to avoid to make these signs useful. These guidelines do not alter the number, size, location, or anything else that's in the ordinance. They're simply illustrations of how to use what you're allowing in the ordinance. And should the guidelines defined in this document are part of sign regulations, a sign developer should be prepared to demonstrate how they perform against these guidelines, but there's not required. It's not like you're doing a design review. Next. Now, here's some just general examples, things to pick upon and things to avoid. The issue here is create a frame. This has no frame to it. So particularly when it has a white background, it tends to look, no matter what its size is, it looks big, but it also tends to float. What you really get pulled into is this expo piece, because that's the only colorful part on the sign. This has a frame, and even though it had some vacancies in the shopping complex, you can see that the frame and even the name on the frame tends to draw your eye into the sign itself to what the contents are. The second is the design and the structural supports themselves. This is really, in my opinion, the swizzle stick approach, where you put something on top of a stick and stick it up as high as you can. While it's up there, it looks out of balance, and also because it's not well framed, no matter how big that gets, it still looks small, because it's small in the sky. Versus Home Depot is actually about that same size, but it's anchored in a frame and it's down within eye view. Second is apply color. This is the Joann's example. It's just big words on a white background, and this is Famous Footwear, and the Famous Footwear is about the same size, but you see it because they've used color in the building front. It's even more apparent when we get down to Best Buy versus Michaels, which is all words. Next. When words are necessary, use a mixture of upper and lower case rather than all upper. These were almost all upper, and if possible, introduce logo elements, particularly if the logo element is part of the business. And last, design the sign in the building as an integral unit. In this case, you can see the hamburger set in front, and then he put something up on the roof, and then he has stuff down on the ground level to try to promote the fact that he makes hamburgers. But they're all uncoordinated, and the building itself, it has no color to it at all. It's all white. So you get distracted by all this without really knowing what it's trying to promote or what it's trying to anchor. Versus this, I think, is, can't tell which franchise this is, but you see all the color, and the sign is relatively small. But the color coordination of the building makes it identifiable, and then the sign becomes part of the building element. Now, this is the sign by sign, type by type, these are the examples. Projecting signs that all stick out. These have colorful logo elements. They're designed to be kind of down at the pedestrian level in order to be read. And you see every one of these pages will go, what's the purpose? What are the design principles? And what are the things to avoid? Next. These are blade signs, as we call them. They stick out from the side of the building. And in the old days, if there were awnings above it, you'd use blade signs to be down at the very level that the pedestrian would see. Blade signs are not very big. They don't need to be very big. They're almost just above pedestrian height. Next. These are what we call canopy fascia. You see the canopy sits up here, and then in the very face of that is where you can put your advertisement. And since these are not very big surfaces, you see, you tend to mute the sign itself. And one of the issues is when you allow these, particularly if you have a building with a long canopy, is to give some frame that's just like we're building element, so you don't fill that whole edge of the canopy up with words and advertisement. Next. These are under awning signs. In most cases, these used to be the signs that hung down from chains. You can see, and this is an interior area, so it's protected from the winds. Where you allow these out in the open areas, you want to make sure you see how these are stabilized, much more structural, so that they'll float around, they can't wave around. In some cases, we allow either under awning or blade, but not both, because they're both serving the same purpose, and that's as you're walking down the street or walking down the sidewalk to be able to tell what you're going to encounter. Next. These are window signs and displays, and you can see some of these. This is what we would call an opaque image. That's an opaque image. But you can see that some of these, like the little logo elements or the word elements that they'll carry along the borders or on the top, are what we would call transparent. You can see in and around the words, and they don't, quote, block the view of what's going on inside. Placement is sometimes important, though, because these are all these little added logos and advertisements are put above or below the eye level, and it doesn't detract from being able to look into the stores, which is what you're really trying to do. Next. These are sandwich signs. And the key issue in the sandwich signs is where they're allowed and how big they can get. They either should be out here on what we call the curb side. This is where the trees and the signs and in some cases parallel parking where the doors are going to go, or they should be right up against the face of the building so the pedestrian way is free of any kind of obstructions. What usually happens is people get carried away with these things and they start dropping them everywhere. And you can see in a lot of cases they're put out on your roadway, which is really kind of inappropriate. They're not really designed for that. These don't have to be very big. And some of them can have fixed contents. This sign just basically says a Calico restaurant, that's what it is. A lot of them have things that change on them, which we're trying to say this is our special for the day. Or in some cases, they'll be used to say this is Farmer's Market and it's open today. The key issue with these is where they're placed and how often they can stay up. And ideally, some of these should be transitory. They're only put up during an event or only put up during a sale or some other case. When they become permanent like this, then you've got to be careful where they're placed and how big they get. The common default size is 9 foot 3x3, but you can see some of these kind of run a 3x4, and that seems to be plenty big, because your only issue is the bigger this gets, the more it's going to encroach upon the sidewalk. Next. These are what we call wall-applied signs, and you can see there's a number of different types here. Some of them are just letters that are put on top of a base. Some are whole design elements that are attached. But the key issue here is color in all these cases. Even the ones that's on a brick, the bank that's on a brick, stands out. And therefore, they don't need to be very big in order to be get done what they need to do. Next. These are what we call signs are well applied, which are large, and I think I've talked about all these before, but this is the only area that's considered the sign, or the sign, or the sign, or the sign, or the sign. The architect has effectively used the building itself to frame that sign, so they don't need to be very big. All of these examples were less than what was allowed in their ordinances. Next. These are wall signs painted. This is Nasty Jack's. It's in LeConnor. Some of these other signs date and are trying to look like, and in some cases they are, historical signs. And the issue is, we couldn't allow something that size if it was just a wall sign now, is that your ordinance needs to make latitudes for things which were historical, or at least based on a historical precedent. Next. These are walls with artwork, and these are almost predominantly artwork. This is in Bellingham. That whole building paints a scene from Bellingham from about the 1900s. And then elsewhere in Fairhaven, they took the back part of a park and they've actually built into, or just painted onto it, kind of an architectural element so it feels like it's part of the building. That's this element right here. And the key issue with this is we start lapping over into artwork as opposed to advertising, then what size is appropriate, and more important becomes what the content is. Is it art or is it not? Keep that in mind because I'm going to show you one example when we get done with this that looks at sculpture, and the issue is it a sign or is it art? And if it's in between, then what do you do about it? Next. These are sculptures. And these are small sculptures in here, and they're kind of put, you see, that this is at the entrance of a brewery, and this sits on top of a burger bar, and this is just a small sign that hangs down instead of trying to say, this is the beer bar or the tavern, it's using that to which to do it. These are much bigger elements. That's the famous Cadillac Ranch. And this is in Kennewick, and there's absolutely no signs on this building at all. There are just two cars. One sits up on the pole, and the other one is crashed into the roof of the building. And it's a burger joint, and that's about all he needs to do to get that idea across. When you allow these, the issue is if they're substituting for, are they advertisement, first of all, and if they're substituting for advertisement, what's the proper size and where should it be placed? Now, one issue that we say in here is avoid things which simply repeat somebody's brand. If this were a Mickey Mouse, or this were a nationally known franchise icon, that's not going to get across the same idea as these. These are all contemporary, funky ideas that are very local and iconic. Next. These are tenant directories, and these are small tenant directories. And in this case, this is a pylon. This is a small sign that's on the front of the complex. You can see these are building complexes, but also this is a sign at the building entrance, and this is a sign also at the building entrance. And these you allow as directory signs, but this size you allow either the entrance to the complex or the entrance to the building. And at this scale, you can see they're not overimposing, but they do allow some presence to tenants who are not going to be simply able to be put up on the big directory sign, just not going to be enough room for them all. Next. Now, these are tenant directories that are moderate in height. Now, the colonnade on this sign, they actually rented out those spaces between when I took pictures. But you can see that these are their major tenants, and they all have some kind of logo elements to what each tenant is, but you see the multicolors really help pop them. And these are doing the same thing. Now, one of the issues here, of course, is the bigger the frame, the bigger imposing it looks, even though the sign face is not very big itself. So at some point in time, if things get out of hand, you got to take a look at just what the ratio of the frame is to the sign so it just doesn't overpower everything. Next. These are freestanding signs. These we call pedestal monuments, and these are low, and there are two kinds in here. One is to just identify who you are. That's the address of the building, and those are the two key tenants. This is also basically what the definition of, this is the Padilla Bay Estuary. But then some of them, and you can see, this is the Coca-Cola's industrial plant. This is the Singing River Mall. Again, they're not very big, but they all define the entrance as you go into the complex. And some of them, you can see, have snuck in tenant directories as well, so they do double face, double purpose. They look more imposing and bigger because, one, they're mounted to the ground, so the ground tends to make them bigger, but you're also seeing them ride a car or eye level if you're in the car or if you're a pedestrian, so they work pretty good. Next. These are moderate height pylons. Some of these are alongside walkways. This one, Chase, is in a pedestrian area. And some of them are simply planted instead of freestanding signs. Now, they have about the same faces to them as you would get on, say, some of those I said were on the big poles that were clear up in the sky. But they're more visible, and because you're using the frame itself as opposed just to the sign area, you're getting more of an impact. And again, this goes back to, let's take the box. This is a German sign. You can see these are the two areas we measure as a sign. The pylon itself, we would simply have to put some dimensions on so it doesn't get out of hand. There's some ratio to that. Next. These are freestanding single pole signs, and these are very low signs. And I can buy that these, you can see that in some cases these are only 15 feet tall, and they tend to work very well, but the key issue here is how graphic they are. And so when you mount them, the graphic elements, and you mount them, even though they're on a single kind of slender pole, they still look somewhat proportional. It's when these get up to be 30 and 35 feet tall that they just look lost. Next. These are still freestanding single pole. These are about moderate height, but you can see the elements are starting to increase in some of these, so they look more balanced. But they're all very graphic. This one is also electronic. This element changes all the time. Next. These are freestanding double pole signs. These are low ones. You can see how the frame works on all of these. And therefore, while the image, the message isn't very big, they've also used a lot of graphic elements to help them out. Next. These are double pole moderate size. And the moderate size is getting up to being about 20 to 30 feet. Now, you can see that some of them have really gotten carried away with their sign frame. Actually, that's a very small signage element, and they're graphic. But they look proportional. They look sizable. They look like they're not only they're going to stand, but it draws your eye right away to wherever their contents is. Most cases, most new city ordinances, and even the examples I showed you, which I said were the good signs in the very beginning, are this height. They're not pushing any higher than that. That's about 30 feet. Some of them even have gone down to 20 feet. Next. Now, I know you don't have billboards, but this is kind of a state-of-the-art billboards. They're not flat anymore. In fact, it used to be that when you did a billboard, you bought a new kind of wallpaper, and you saw the guys out there, and they painted the wallpaper over that surface. Well, now they've gotten really innovative. So this thing is kind of supposed to represent a balloon hanging over the sign. This is a changing image. This is also a changing image. This has kind of three-dimensional elements put to it. And even though you don't allow billboards per se, it's just trying to show you this is kind of the direction you're seeing even in the smaller signs, where the advertiser in this case is not a business. I mean, it's a business, but it's not located at that site. And this is to get your attention. Next case. And these are the billboards that are electronic. And these are not very big. This one is mounted almost down at sidewalk level, but this whole thing is like a giant LED screen that changes constantly. And it can be programmed. In this case, it's not business related. It can be programmed to be any kind of advertising it wants to be. And that's the difference between a billboard and all the other types that we define. Billboards are not tied to the site that they're sited at. They don't necessarily promote the business on where they're located. They can sell anything anywhere. So one of your key issues to avoid this kind of a problem, if you call it a problem, is to say that the sign content has to relate to the business on which the sign is located, and it has to be business located, business oriented, and only a certain percent of that could be, say, a product like Coca-Cola or something else. And these signs will not proliferate then. These are reader boards of two kinds. This is the old kind where the letters are actually put on the white face, and as I said, this is the way the manual ones are always going to be, because that you have to backlight those letters to be able to see them. This is the new electronic. These are about the same size. But reader boards are also in gas stations, and in some cases they're informational about what's happening in the convention center or what's happening in the business. The issue with these, because these are still reader boards, they're still passing on information. They're not doing overt graphics as you saw in the one before that. Is their size and their placement. Next. These are reader boards, pedestal gasoline, and the issue here is to get them down low to the ground, and do you allow these as supplements to normal gas station signage? In some cases, allow them in other areas where you may not want the reader board. The key issue here is the change in gas prices. Some of these are manual, and some of these are becoming increasingly electronic because we change them so quickly. Next, please. These are real estate construction signs. And the key issue here is, again, the examples I showed you, which I liked, were the double poles, and they look like they are a nice improvement. But they also look like they are properly structurally sound. They're not just temporarily planted out there. This is an example of one of the banners that you put up on a construction site, and the key issue there is usually say one banner, everybody's got to be on that banner. Otherwise, every subcontractor and every consultant will come out and hang their own banner. And then this is a pedestrian open house kind of sandwich board sign. Thanks. Inflatables. Besides electronics, this is also the biggest part of the growth industry, and you can get inflatable for almost anything. And the key issue with the inflatables is, are they anchored, and how long do they stay up? This one particular comes back every other month and stays up for about 2-3 weeks because I think that's what the ordinance said the inflatable could do. And there are interesting and fun, and the only issue is that they be properly tethered down so they're not a safety hazard. And the other question is they don't become ad hoc full-time advertising that then kind of supplants or defeats the purposes of the advertising sites to begin with. The only, back up for 1 minute, the only issue on some of them is they can be mounted on roofs. And they can be sighted on a roof, and they are also temporary, not like a permanent roof sign. But again, the issue is how long can they be there, and are they really part of your advertising? And our neck of the woods, the biggest one that came out was SpongeBob. And he was out 2 days and somebody stole it. And he was a huge, you can't imagine what you would do with SpongeBob. He's bigger than any garage. But he disappeared within minutes. Next. Now these are signs that are integrated with the building motif. And this is the direction you see all the franchises going. So this is Jack in the Box. And your Jack in the Box out there, that's the same thing. You see it's how colorful it is. The signage element is not very big at all. This is one of the pizza joints. This is Panda Express. And I can't read with that one. I think that's Boston's. The sign element is not the issue. And they make very good use of a minimum amount of space for the sign elements. Some of them, though, can get just, you have to anticipate where they're going. Boston's is all neon. All those little arcs are neon. So at night, that neon element is lit up. And because neon is not defined as part of the sign, it's not saying Boston's on it, it's exempt. And that can be okay in certain circumstances unless it just gets out of hand. Or in some cases, if you don't want that element where you don't think it's appropriate. Some historical downtowns have said no neon at all, for example. Next. Now we're going to get into lighting. These are overhead lights. That means that's a flat sign, has no lighting element at all, and you can see the lights up here that light up the sign. These are under lights, and these are overhead lights. And the key issue in lighting is that it not glare anywhere except the sign. It has to be focused on the sign face. These are lots of historical districts like these because that's closer to what they were in the old times. Although, frankly, in the historical 1890s main streets, for example, we didn't have that much electricity. We just had the basic sign itself. We had gas lights and street lights. Next. These are unique design neons. This is all neon in the face. This is neon in the face, just the lettering to it, and then it also has neon running around the sign face and on the building faces and so on. But you can see they also are very colorful because neon works best at night, not during the daytime. So the sign has to be kind of two-dimensional. It has to have something that works during prime daytime hours, something that works at prime nighttime hours. None of these are all relatively small signs, but the neon allows them to have a bigger impact than they would normally be. And you can see this is almost called a fascia sign, and these are projecting signs, so they by ordinance are small, and they've compensated for that by using neon elements. Next. These are what's called halo pin mounted backlight, and that's where you put the lettering on the front, and behind that you can see in Motivo here or in Fatigues the lighting behind that makes this lettering stand out at night. And this is a little even more dramatic. Diggers has done that, and it's shining through the glass elements of the signage and making it look even bigger and more interesting. Next. These are what's called open pin channel single stroke neon. Basically, it's lettering laid across a channel, and then the lighting is incorporated a little bit behind that element, in some cases inside the signage element itself. So at night, you can see this is designed to be red in the daytime, and at night, all of that lights up. Now, some of the signs from here on, some cities have don't think that they're appropriate to certain areas, mainly historical areas. So like Snoqualmie bans everything in their downtown except flat painted signs with exterior lights. But in their new town, and some of these are examples are pulled from that new development up on the ridge, they find that these are actually much more fun. Not these, but all of these were much more fun. And that the downtown, the historical downtown, started to look a little uninterested and a little kind of darkish. So the key question is not necessarily always what you allow, it's how well it's designed. Next. These are the same thing. These are double stroke neon. Double stroke means that there's the whole letter is outlined rather than just the letter itself, and then these light up on the exterior. They're a little bigger. They have a little bit more presence to them than the single stroke. But again, they don't have to be very big in order to get across what they want to get across, although they have to design these for daytime and nighttime. Next. These are internally illuminated. That means that the light is behind this sign. So this is designed so that when the light shines through, it shines through all these elements at nighttime. These are almost what we call pan signs. It's even true of the Starbucks. Light is inside each one of those letters. The only the bad thing in these things is that the store's got to keep the tubes working. I don't know how many. You don't see Starbucks blow out a few letters very often, but a lot of the signs, they'll get very sophisticated in this, then they don't know how to maintain them, and then all of a sudden you've got kind of poor-looking kind of impact. Next. This is neon over flush cut. And it's just a different sign, but you can see here, these really become neon signs. And this sign is not very big. It's a very small sign. It's put on the face of a restaurant. But given not only its neon capability, and this is not very garish neon, but the backlighting part of it, it has a big presence on the street. Next. These are individual channel lumen letters. All that means is that each letter has its own light inside of it, and therefore the whole letter lights up, and it becomes bigger element than before. However, the issue here is that probably is the same size sign as all the things you saw before. But the impact of this by lighting up the whole letter makes it look bigger. Next. And finally, we're getting into what we call box signs. And this is what used to be the bane of everybody, because it would be a square sign, it would be white, it would light up it with fluorescent lights behind it, and then you used to have some little black letters on it. But you can see these are more imaginative than that, so just simply banning one type of sign is not necessarily a way to guarantee good design. Next. This is the same thing. This is can signs. And in this case, they've actually cut out all these little spaces, so it actually looks like individual lights, and it's just the way that the sign was made. But you can see they can be just as interesting. So therefore, the point being, the type of sign is not the issue. The design is. Next. And that's the end of that. Now, I want to show you, however, one controversy in two different cities about what were signs and what was art. Because a lot of times you'll design your signage and you'll have very definite prescriptions on what it is, and then something comes along that says it's art, and take touchdown here.
Okay.
And it falls in the cracks, and then you don't know what to do with it. This is a church. It's alongside a freeway between Dayton and Cincinnati. And the church put it up, and the question was, even it just has some scripture on it, but they called it their sign, not artwork. And the locals dubbed it Touchdown Jesus because it looks like it's a touchdown. But because there wasn't a definition of what's art and what's sign, it went through the cracks. That's kind of a moot point because lightning hit Touchdown and he went up in flames in about 3 minutes. But this is a replacement, and he's been nicknamed Hug Me Jesus. But it's the same issue. Is it art or is it a sign? And if it's art, then it really is going to fall under a different kind of constitutional issue than if it's a sign. Go to the next one. This is Maryland. Maryland was originally done by an artist, and I can't remember whether it was put up in Chicago or New York. But then Palm Springs bought it and brought it to, it's a big size, you can see, our big art piece, brought it to Palm Springs and put it up, and you see, that's their excuse for the sign element. Is it sign or is it art? And they would say this is art because an artist did it on commission in a different city, not Palm Springs. So I thought I'd show, I thought I'd show you the extremes that you can go in these kinds of things.
What are they advertising?
Palm Springs.
And the association is?
Maryland.
So it could have been Bob Hope.
Could have been. This is the iconic scene from Some Like It Hot. And so they've used that because of its sign and kind of its notoriety. They're using that to promote Palm Springs.
It's more like a gateway.
It's a gateway. You could say that. This is in a very prominent position as you come into town. All right, back to go back to the tables again, and I'll show you where we are in the.
Yeah, we could use that.
Go to this one. There you go. Now this is where I am in your current code. I'm a little, frankly, a little behind. Most of my family got sick last week, so that kind of slowed me down a bit. But what I'm still doing is taking your current ordinance and interpreting it into this table format and correcting it in some cases because the first cut didn't get it completely right. And those clarifications that I've got so far in yellow, and then I'm starting to introduce some new proposals in addition to what you saw from before, where I think it'll either help clarify the intent or give you some choices about what to do. So very quickly, because I didn't have you get this in your packet because it's just not done yet, and I'd rather get it all done once and give it to you than have us in between and have a number of iterations. But for example, in the yellow here, this should be exits and entries per vehicle. This should have been parcel, not property. And so those are just clarifications. Next page.
Tom, I got a question on that thing there. On the info wayfinding and info gateway, the comments say citywide system of gateway signs, citywide system of gateway elements. I'm not clear as to what that means.
If you put up wayfinding signage, for example, that's probably what it should say, wayfinding. And you're directing, the wayfinding signs are the type you see in I don't know whether Snohomish has them, it says the business district is this way, the downtown is this way, city hall is this way. And the issue there is rather than trying to permit and take a look at each individual sign, you're really looking at a family or a system of signs, then you look at all the signs, and they're all are subject to your ordinance.
Okay.
And the political issue there is if you exempt your own city signs from your ordinance, then you run the risk that you look like you have double standards. And rather than trying to bring each one of these in and do them independently, you say, we'll bring the whole system in, and if you and council adopt the whole system, then that's the basis for authorizing it.
Okay, thank you.
Next. Now, here's a clarification. When I went through your ordinance the first time, all of your ordinance is written by type of sign, not by zoning district. I'm trying to transfer those into the zoning districts. And these signs were listed as being allowable in all these zones, including downtown commercial. And therefore, the first time I went through, I said I didn't find sandwich boards or projecting signs or some of these other things in your downtown. It's because I forgot that these were all still in this category, and I hadn't taken them, putting them in every zone district rather than by signs. Now, I'm starting to do that, and as I do that, it'll be a little redundant. So, for example, you'll see sandwich signs or projecting signs allowed in four or five different zone classifications. But I think it's easier than trying to have one area so this covers everybody, and then later on you only have the exceptions by the zoning district. Because most people that come in, they'll know the zoning district they're in, then they're going to want to see what's allowed, everything, in that page in that zoning district. Yeah?
On your sandwich board signs, now for civic organizations and versus commercials, the civic nonprofit type people do garage sales maybe once a year, would they be... The permit be the same as a commercial for having them up all year?
No. They're under the limited duration of the temporaries, and I haven't gone back through all these yet to check whether or not I've changed some of them already that don't require permits.
We've got an exempt category as well.
Exempt. Some signs are exempt, and you'll see that in the ordinance itself. It'll list them like church signs, identifying what the church is, or that type of thing. The only thing here that I corrected so far, I took the downtown commercial out, because you'll see when we get to that category, I've put their proper ones in. And actually, one advantage of putting them each time in each zone is you might have different assumptions about how big a projecting sign would be in general commercial versus the downtown commercial, where the current ordinance has them all the same size. Is this issue of the wall mural, and it's percent allowable of the mural area that can be commercial, not just the sign. Next. Now, one thing I've also added, because your ordinance does this kind of indirectly, it'll give a certain maximum sign size, and then it'll say, well, if you have two frontage streets, or if you have so many more tenants, then you can have a different total maximum size. And then at the very beginning of your ordinance, it says, if you quote your allocation by site or building, you're subject to all of them being added up, and there's a maximum. And that wasn't clear the first time I did it, and it wasn't clear the first time I did this. So what you'll see at the bottom of some of these zones is total sign area. I forgot to put it in here. It'll be the wall, freestanding, and directory signs. That they will have maximums when they're all added up. That was your intent in your original ordinance. Next. Now, you can see maximum allowed for all wall, monument, freestanding signs combined. Here's the additional, this is the downtown. See, you did have allowances for sandwich, you did have wall murals, you did have projecting, you did have changeable message. I just didn't have it broken out by that zone, which I'll carry through and do. The only thing proposed here, though, was to do away with the roof sign. Not allow future roof signs. That mean anything that's up now is grandfathered. But generally, that's not the direction that we've been going. Now, that's subject to your making that decision, but at least would be the suggestion that would be. Next. Now, this is a new zone I didn't have information on, your mixed use. And these are the yellow areas of what's in your current ordinance. And the pink areas are the areas that I would introduce. You should have these kinds of window signs and awning signs allowed. And then down here, I'm trying to figure out how to come up with the total sign maximum so that we don't have to replicate over and over and over again what those formulas are. I've also done something else in this. You have some formulas that work when you're single tenant on a single street, and you have another formula where you have multiple streets. So I may be able to simplify this if we simply call them out in that fashion. But the key issue is that everything is here, and try to simplify how it's presented on each line, so you can understand it, and this doesn't get so convoluted we can't keep up with what we're trying to say. Now, there is one area, though, that I've not gotten to. You have a definition of freestanding along state highway rights of way, and you want a different allowance for what that is. The only thing that bothers me is, let's not use state highway right of way. Let's name them. If you use an abstract, then there's always going to be a question, well, you've got three state highways in town. Which one is it, and where is it? You may as well call them out and make them site-specific. That's much safer than leaving them open. And I say that because in some cases, some jurisdictions have found that they define that, and then all of a sudden somebody goes in and subdivides the property simply because they can put another sign that has freeway and state highway frontage. The best example of that is Fife. There are property underneath those billboards that are strictly billboard properties. And in that case, they're tribal-owned, so they're not subject to the Highway Signage Act. Next. This is your general service commercial. I'm not adding in all the signs here, but I have clarified that some of these things are per street frontage, and I may end up with, you know, single streets and multiple streets. And I've started to clarify that and pull out this total signage area for a single tenant and a total signage area for a multiple tenant, what the rules are for that. Next. This is industrial districts. This is the same clarifying street frontage and getting into what the total sign is for different kinds of tenants. So this would be your total sign face. So you could basically be looking at how you add up the different type signs you're authorized. Next. No changes here. Well, 15-foot height, I think, was what was called out in this. I just didn't pick it up the first time. Next. I've gotten so far, at least, to know that your current orders doesn't require permits for those. I haven't worked my way through every sign, but when I get down, it'll reflect what your current ordinance says, and then you can decide from there. The one thing I did take out is, remember, I had this proposal that no sign within 100 feet of school grounds or park. And we took that out because, based on the last workshop, you thought that wasn't necessary. Next. And this was a...
Screwed that up. Are we okay?
Yeah, we're okay. This is just an additional footnote on a certain sign. You're over the right-of-way banner signs. You only allow in a certain area of the city, and that's Main and Lewis Street. Now, I'm not done with this, and I do apologize because I hope to be further along in this to where I could give you a draft and you could have some time to look it over and we get back together. I'll probably have this all caught up by the end of this week. So the next time we get together, you'll have had time to review it. And I'll also have this, not just this, but some other changes in your ordinance where it's easier, it catches up to what this is trying to say. So the next time we get together, you'll have had time to look at this over in detail and look over the ordinance in detail. We can talk then about what's in there. There are some new things that will be in there that, like in your sign design guidelines, I don't have as much on current electronic signs. I'll probably, if you agree, take out the billboard stuff and put that in instead, because that's an area that you do want some guidance on. And in your ordinance language, there'll be some additional information on how ambient light issues are being, and the pulsating issues are being dealt with on a national basis. We're on the right track. You comfortable? What do you think of the sign design guidelines using those?
Using pictures. I like it.
You like that?
Mm-hmm.
Are they appropriate?
I think mostly.
Okay.
On first review.
Okay.
Did a fine job.
Good. Okay.
I did notice that in some cases there could be an overlap where you have like a single pole versus a pedestal, where some signs are on a like a pedestal on the side with a sign coming off the top of it. You could call that, I guess, a pedestal with a sign on top of it.
Some of them are high.
Or you can call it a single pole or whatever. Yeah, but for the most part, I think it was a good job. Yeah.
Good. Okay. David?
I guess there's two areas that I'm trying to work through. One, the comment you made about the ratio between the frame and the sign. Seems to me that that needs to be somehow defined in regulation.
I think it does.
So we don't have anything on that yet.
No.
Okay.
But you can see the direction is they're making the sign frame bigger and bigger and bigger to get bigger impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really valid concern. The other question I have, and it's one I've always had when we talk about design guidelines, it's interpretation and application. Who has the power? You set forth the design guidelines, and someone on staff has to make a decision as to whether it complies or not.
This does not make... It doesn't use the sign design guidelines for design review. This ordinance, or the proposal, I guess, that I would have to you, is simply make it an illustration to be used as informational only at this point. And then if you get good results, don't go any further than that. But if you decide you want to get into design review, that's a much more complicated, sticky wicket. Because you can see the eyes and the beholder of a lot of that stuff. And if you get into it, what most ordinances or most cities have done to try to regulate their signs is go regulate the product And you can see from all the examples that the product doesn't have anything to do with it. Whether it's a pants on or a halo pin or whatever it is, it's really the designer themselves figuring out how to make it effective. So I would say at this point, just stick with them as illustrations.
And yet then I fall back to your page that talks about the purpose of those illustrations.
Give good examples.
And you said something in your introduction about how legally you need to have some, and you pointed to these six bullet points that are in bold on that page, one of your design guidelines. And I guess that's where it seems like we're wanting to cross over that line of just saying, yeah, this is what good, versus trying to somehow incorporate it into the code.
True. You'll see that if you look at the very first section of your ordinance, it states what gives you the authority to regulate signs. And there's issues in there about safety, but there's also issues in there about aesthetics. That it's perfectly proper or legal for you to manage how it's done. Not that it can't be done. That's a constitutional right that you can advertise. But as a community, you can decide its size, its placement, and you can do that for safety reasons as well as aesthetic reasons. And I re-emphasize that in the beginning of the sign design guidelines, but not necessary to make the guidelines themselves to have the same stature as your ordinance.
So where in our ordinance, the markup that we've got, is that talked about?
Your very first page. And your existing ordinance, as it's written.
And that would be the long paragraph at the top there before the definition?
Yeah, yeah. Purpose. Your current purpose pretty much covers what's required to make yourself legally defensible. And it lays out why you're doing it. You're doing it to be responsive to locating business establishments and so on and so on, but you cite economic development, you cite effectiveness, you cite quality and placement, you cite also public safety and so on. The reasons why you're venturing into the sign business, sign ordinance, regulating them. And all I did in the sign design guidelines was use the same thing, but pull them out in a different way.
But if I look at the language, it's really pretty mushy, it seems.
In what? In your existing ordinance?
Yes.
It's not as clear as we're going to propose to you when we get done.
Okay. Because it talks about new signage being creative and distinctive. Well, that to me is in the eye of the beholder.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't use it in those words. You'll see the draft says why you're into it and aesthetics is a reason, but you don't get into defining aesthetics.
Okay.
It's a difficult, when you get into the quote design content, then it becomes a whole different game plan. Not one that everybody's quite figured out how to do. And I think the reason, one of the usefulnesses of the design guidelines is to illustrate there are no absolute rules. You can have a really good quality sign and be small. You can have a really good quality sign and be effective and use neon. You can use pan lighting. You can use wall sign. I mean, you can use, the real question is how innovative your aesthetics are as opposed to how big it is or where it's placed. Even though that's still important. What you regulate in your ordinance is placement, size, setbacks, and some of the other things dealing with safety. But if you're trying to emphasize your aesthetics, do that by example.
And would you hope that we would end up at a place where the ordinance would not support some of these, for instance, that you've identified as the bad?
Well, that would be up to you. Like single pole signs over a certain height, I think that is unaesthetic, but I'm not sure that I would absolutely prohibit it. I would try to point out to sign designers, it doesn't look as good. It's up to you as to whether you want to move into the next direction and say, we want pylons or we want double poles. That's not going to infringe on their constitutional right. But if you get inside the content of the sign, then you're in a different game. I think it's the same thing on height. A lot of cities are going to smaller height, as you can see, and they're pushing the pylons, and they are pushing the double pole because now it'll look better, but they start bringing down the size and getting them more manageable without going into the content of the sign.
And I think an example of that might be up at the corner of Highway 2 and North Kelsey at this point, the AutoZone sign. I've noticed I sit there waiting for the light to change, and I can't hardly see the sign for all the clutter that's in front of it, having to do with signals and wires and poles, and it seems to be much less effective. If it had been 10 feet less height, it might have been a more effective sign.
Well, that 76 line I showed you, too. It's higher than it needs to be to for you to be able to see it. I think the other issue, though, as you saw from the examples, the thing that is the most distracting, that creates the most clutter, are all the posters and the sandwich signs and the banners and so on, which are ill-conceived and ill-placed. If you took those out, if those weren't there cluttering the view, you could live with a lot of what I would call not the most pleasing solutions without looking like you were just junked up your street. So I would think that if you're going to be careful, it's when and where you allow banners and posters and these kind of temporary things. And as I said, unless your ordinance says you cannot do those or it gives very definite rules, every franchisor will control your signage by default.
Right. Thank you.
Jeff.
Yeah, I was thinking about Mill Creek, you know, the new town center area. And then you go out into 164th or Butler Highway, where it's quite gauche, kind of Route 2. Then you drive down that narrow street in the newer development. It's a completely different look. But I, you know, we just can't go back. Route 2 is never going to look like that.
No.
But going forward, I just, you know, I like everything you've done. I think we have to, I personally, I'm not a minutia guy, trust you and Mark. You guys know what you're doing.
We act like we do.
Yeah. And all we can ask for is when someone comes in and talks to Mark about a sign, you know, that he's fair, he uses discretion, and he's reasonable to people, and lets them, you know, go about their business. But I think in a lot of ways the market's going to decide.
It will.
You know, you're not going to have Walmart with a, you know, 50-foot-long banner that's flopping in the wind. That's just not going to happen. You know, even if they have the right to do it, I just don't see it happening that way. And so in a lot of ways, these places are holding each other accountable, because this guy drives by that has the flopping sign, and he sees this really nice sign, well-designed, you know, really sharp. Why are you getting my act together? You know, the flopping sign just isn't cutting it anymore. So I think a lot of it's going to take care of itself. But I really like what you've done and your, you know, your grasp of it. I don't have 20, 30 years to learn all of this so that I can judge it on a minute basis. So I appreciate what you've done.
Okay. I think you're right in the sense that the market will gradually reward good signage and good advertising. But these are expensive signs. Even a bad sign is an expensive amount of money to put into it. And usually these businesses, particularly the small ones, have to put that money up front. So once it's up, whether it's good or bad, it's going to stay there until they're somewhat profitable enough to change. The chains are the ones that are pushing the newer designs. As you can see, the franchise restaurants are very different. The gas station signs are coming down in height and are being redesigned about how they do it. You can see a lot of the newer buildings. Look at Red Robin, colorful building facade, and then the signage is not very big. Those trends, I think, are going to start dictating the market. What we found is more effective at times than trying to do it all by regulation is to give out awards for the best signs in town, the newest best signs in town. And so sometimes the Chamber of Commerce will do that, and sometimes they'll have raspberry signs for those who have the most abusive or worst case. And their peer pressure does work much more effective than trying to zero in on regulation. It's just tighter and tighter and doesn't really achieve much. So I think you're right. I agree with you.
Yes. Are we going to make this code enforcement easier on this one than what it is now?
I think it is easier if it's understandable and very, very clear about what you're going to do. There will be an issue, though, about reserving the right to do step in certain circumstances. For example, your sandwich board signs, those are the ones that usually get out of hand. I don't think you want that anybody expects there to be a sign cop that goes around and monitors everything. But you need something in the ordinance that says when it really gets out of hand, you do have the ability to go in and enforce. The question is, when you'll see that, is what you're comfortable with and what you're not comfortable with. Now, if you don't have something there somewhere, then when things really get out of hand, there's nothing you can do. You don't want to be in that situation either. When's your next meeting?
January, second Monday in January. No more meeting in December. Although when you finish the revisions to the table, we can go ahead and send that material out well ahead of the next meeting.
Yeah.
No later than 2 weeks from now, you'll have a draft of it all in one package, and that'll be the draft that we'll want you to comment on, rather than having any interims. Is that okay? Okay, thank you.
Just one more comment. I appreciate what you said about, take for instance, the restaurants and the way that they've taken a different approach to their signage. And I think it's a very positive.
The franchises.
The franchises. And even Tuscano's, which is not a franchise, has a standalone brand. Denny's on Highway 2 took a very different approach on their signage, and that they kept it low. I think it's very effective. And yet, I think it's also clear that if we allow it, there will be those that will maximize it.
There will do what?
There will be those that will maximize it. And I'm thinking of height. And I think we need to keep that in mind. When Jeff comments that the market will drive it, to a certain extent, I agree. But then at the same time, you will always get those outliers who will go to whatever they can with a maximum size, height, color, whatever, lighting. And I just hope that we're careful about that.
You need to set boundaries. True, but I think the boundaries that you are most important are the number, the size, the location of them, and the height, as opposed to doing that and then trying to get into the design of the sign, which is very difficult.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Merry Christmas, you guys. I'll see
you. Thank you, John. You did a good job. Thank you. Paul, yeah. Mark, do we have anything else?
I don't think so. Like I said, we'll get, as soon as we get information from Tom, we'll get it sent out to you well ahead of the next meeting. And in that next meeting, we should be able to really focus in on the proposed and try and get worked through that.
Making good progress so far. I think so. Okay. Then I guess we move on to a discussion by commissioners and staff. I guess we'll start off with Mark. Anything on that?
Well, I guess my comments, if I might take my time for that on the sign ordinances, I think it's really come a long ways, and I look at signs almost every day, and I'm going to be much happier to be using this code than what we had, and I think some of the suggestions we've had tonight have been great, and I think we can incorporate those into what we have, and it's really going a great direction.
I like it. Yeah, I agree. I think so. Paul?
A couple things that you all know that Commissioner Lutz resigned his position with the commission for personal reasons. So we are advertising, looking for potential candidates to fill Paul's seat. And we'll schedule elections maybe the first meeting in January. And a couple of project updates. We're expecting a decision tomorrow from the hearing examiner on the Cable Park. He'll be making a decision on the substantial development permit, shoreline substantial development permit.
Mm-hmm.
And he will be making a recommendation to council for the shoreline conditional use permit, two permits that are tied together on the Cable Park. And that will go to council on December 18th for some discussion, and most likely their first meeting is January 8th next year, or they may potentially hold a second a meeting between the 18th and the 8th, which would which might well include their decision on the Cable Park. Also on the 18th, a couple of other projects coming up that we've discussed here, the North Kelsey guidelines, changes to that are coming to council for a final, second and final reading on the 18th of this month, and the school mitigation fees, the comp plan amendments and the zoning code chapter 20 amendments we talked about are coming, that was to council last week, and they'll be making their final action next week on the 18th as well. So things are moving forward.
Okay. Anything else?
I don't think so.
No. Yep.
Nothing.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas. That's Merry Christmas. Jeff, do you have anything?
The only thing of value, I think, is Galaxy Theater. You might all know we no longer city no longer owns it. And I was out there today, and AM/PM asphalt's measuring up for speed bumps, and those stupid ecology blocks are going to disappear probably Thursday or Friday of this week.
Year.
So, from a planning commission's perspective, it's probably the least neighborly thing that we have in this town, in my opinion. The next step of that, that you'll probably hear at some future date, is we are going through a phased approach researching the landfill, trying to figure out where the garbage is inside the landfill, isolate it, and figure out what we can do with that property. Turn it into commercial property, potentially. So that process is kind of working its way through the staff phase right now. Council has authorized $50,000 to do phase one and phase two on that. And at some point, it doesn't have a commercial designation on it, so eventually we will be back, you know, through that whole land use designation process to fix that problem. And if it turns out that it's economically viable.
Any update on Walmart?
Walmart, we're still waiting for the Court of Appeals to set the hearing date. They did not establish it in January. They haven't published their late February, early March docket yet. I would expect to see that up on their website in the next, who knows, the courts act in very mysterious ways.
Okay.
You will receive, probably within the next couple of weeks, I would think, there will be a determination on the red light cameras from the Court of Appeals, so that'll their opinion will probably be coming out in the next couple of weeks on that.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
You bet.
Okay, with that, I entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move to adjourn. Second.
Yeah, a motion by Commissioner Rowland to adjourn, and seconded by Commissioner Demarest. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Have you seen anything?
I have one question.